podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Wisden World Cup Daily Podcast. We didn't just not get a close game today, we actually got the biggest mauling in the history of men's World Cup cricket. Australia beat the Netherlands by a colossal 309 runs after hundreds from David Warner and Glenn Maxwell. Maxwell's was a record-breaking effort, the fastest in World Cup history and the fourth fastest of all time in ODI cricket. We'll talk about that game, preview England-Sri Lanka and discuss the lack of close games so far in the tournament. I'm Yaz Rana, and with me today is Ben Gardner. Ben, let's start with Maxwell, a genuinely incredible innings. It's a high-scoring ground, but this is a decent Dutch attack. He didn't face his first ball until the 41st over, and he walked off the field in the 50th over with a 40-ball 100, 8 sixes, 9 fours and 44 deliveries at the crease. That was very special.
Yeah, I mean, that's my favourite stat from the lot, is that he faced his first ball in the 41st over. That's a record among many records that he set today. And you had it in the comparison to David Warner's, also very good 100, but and he didn't even really crawl to 100. He didn't get to face that many balls through it. He was just knocking singles and someone else at the other end. And he took about 8 overs to get there. And in the same time span, Maxwell basically had 100. It was ridiculous, and also, like, this is a good Netherlands bowling attack. You know, like, we've seen in World Cups batters feast on, you know, the bowling attack of a lower team, but Netherlands are here for a reason, and we saw some of that even, you know, in the early stage of the game, I guess, and then he just completely took the game away from them. The two shots in particular, one which he got to 50, which was, it was a reverse sweep sort of, but that doesn't do it justice at all, right? It was like a proper Yorker.
It was like a hockey shot almost.
Yeah, exactly.
It was the speed at which the ball flew away from the bat that was remarkable. And it was a pretty well executed Yorker, only missing the perfect spot by a few inches.
Yeah, and some of these shots, you understand where they get the power from, because they're in like a really sort of like low position, hitting from down to up, and they're all kind of like, they're still in it. And he was nothing like that. Like, his knees were kind of like half bent, his bat was almost like vertical in a way, and he just flicks it away and it goes for 6. And then the same over, he goes to play the same shot, and it's a bouncer this time, and he also hits this one reverse pull shot again with enough force to get it for 6. And so that was extraordinary, and it's good he's come to the party as well. I mean, he's had a very good World Cup record, has Maxwell, and he was brilliant for them in the 2015 World Cup as that kind of luxury number 6 option. But he's had a little bit of a lean time of it in ODIs, and I don't think, we're going to talk about Head a bit later, I don't think his place was under any real threat, but Australia are slowly ticking the boxes that they need to be World Cup contenders, and him being back in form is a big one of those, I guess.
Mm. If you haven't watched his innings, you've got to seek out the highlights. Those shots were brilliant, but he was just totally brutal throughout the innings.
And again, the innings were about 5 minutes long.
So yeah. a word for Baz the leader, 115 off his 10 overs, the most expensive spell in the history of men's ODI cricket, but they're not the worst figures of all time.
No, those are still Mick Lewis's and Adam Zampa's, because neither of them took a wicket, and he took 2 for, you know, so that's something.
Briefly, your moment of the game.
Well, it was a funny little passage in the space about 5 balls when Van der Merwe grasped one and then caught one. The one that he grasped was David Warner hit it to mid-wicket. He dives, he sort of catches it, but he's kind of half juggling it, which means he presses it to the floor as he lands. The Netherlands team look a bit baffled as it's ruled not out, but they clearly haven't been following the Ashes, because that's exactly what happened to Mitch Stark in that series when he tried to catch Ben Duckett. But Australia were adamant that the Stark catch should have been out, and Smith clearly still feels the same way, because he offered Van der Merwe a very similar chance, cutting to point this time in the next over, and this time it was low, but he did hold on properly. So that was quite fun, I suppose.
Mm. Australia, I think, are probably the most steady side in these sort of games. They're almost immune to upsets. They've got players who are particularly ruthless in these games. Warner with the bat, obviously, but then with the ball, they've got bowlers that players who don't play a lot of games against the best teams in the world are likely not to have come up against bowlers like that. You know, Stark is a 90 mile per hour left arm seamer. the pace, but also the bounce of Hazelwood and Cummins. And then also you've got Zampa, who just relentlessly targets the stumps. Like, if you think of all the big cricket nations, they all have had a semi-recent major 50-over World Cup upset go against them, whereas Australia are probably the only one, I think that's right, who are genuinely immune from those sort of results. What have you made of their recent run? That's now three wins on the bounce following defeats to India and South Africa. They've got a huge game against New Zealand on Saturday. And I sort of wonder, now the tournament, we've seen more of the tournament, well, India and South Africa are the two most dangerous and explosive sides. So I wonder if actually a lot of us read too much into how Australia did in those two games.
Yeah, and also, I mean, Australia's players, some of them hadn't played a huge amount of 50-over cricket. And so we were talking about Pat Cummins earlier in the tournament, right? And we were, I guess, sort of fairly enough at that point questioning his place on the side. But also we were saying that there was no reason kind of a priori that Cummins couldn't work out 50-over cricket. You know, you'd think he had the tools of a middle-over bowler.
What does a priori mean?
It means like from first principle. So you don't look at him and there's nothing about Cummins that says this guy can't crack ODI cricket. He just wasn't cracking ODI cricket, right?
Okay, yeah.
So he was he bowls at a good pace. He can succeed on dead surfaces. He's got a good short ball. All that stuff should make him a good middle-overs bowler. It wasn't quite happening. And then he plays a few ODIs and he becomes a bit better at it, basically. And that's going for a few of them. I guess one of the questions about them is it still David Warner, weirdly? Like, he's obviously he's got this 100, he's got the other big 100. He's a World Cup titan, but recently we've seen Warner get big scores against some of the weaker sides and not have the same success against some of the best sides. And they will want him to tick that off, because if Warner is properly back in form against and can take on all manners of bowlers, that does change their side. And then Travis Head's going to come back in. Again, we're going to talk about him. They're good. And I mean, that's one of the reasons why it's so hard to see England or Pakistan, even though it's not mathematically out of the question. And if either of them do go and win all their remaining games, then they will have a pretty good shot at the semi-finals. It's just that those four teams just look too good to let that happen, basically. Mm. And Australia, like, after a bit of a wobble, fully deserve to be counted among them, I think.
Cody asks, given Head is bound to return, what do you do to try and fit him in? Do you drop a batter in Marnus? Do you drop the all-rounder Green or Stoinis, or go in with three quicks plus Marsh? Head is one of the most destructive ODI players in the world. I know that he's not played in a World Cup before, at least not played a prominent part in a World Cup before, but you can see from the way he bats in Test cricket that his game suits how 50-over cricket is played, and his record in the last 2 years at the top of the order is ridiculous. He's going to come in if he's fit. It's likely that he will be fit in the next game or two. How do you think they should get him back in the side?
Yeah, I guess there's two options, really. They either leave out that seam bowling all-rounder in Green or Stoinis, which they've gone back and forth. Or maybe there's three options, but I think there's two real options, which is that or Marnus Labuschagne, who, you know, was a late entry into the World Cup side and World Cup squad, and could easily be the guy to move aside. There's also maybe Marsh, if they want to just keep that, but I think that's a lesser option. My instinct is what they will do is leave out Labuschagne, just go back to that formula they've had. But I wonder if it's relevant that today Marsh bowled four overs, bowled them pretty well, and Cam Green wasn't used at all. And then actually, if you then have an opening pair of Head and Warner, and then Marsh at number three, you've got that's a luxury. That's a brilliant top three to have. And then so if they come off, you're absolutely fine. You're flying. You promote Maxwell. Maybe, you know, if 25, 30 overs, you're three down. Maybe you have Smith knock around for a bit. And then if they collapse, if you have a bit of a wobble, because that could do with three attacking batters, then you've got kind of a collapse insurance in Smith and Labuschagne, who can come up and get you up to maybe a defendable total or help you to rebuild. And then you're depending on what Zampa, Cummins, Hazelwood, Stark for 40 of your overs. That's fine. That's pretty bankable. And then you've got Maxwell, Head, Marsh for the other 10. You can probably muddle through that. And is Stoinis or Green adding that much more than one of those others relative to what you lose with the bat? I don't think so. So I think that's what they should do. And okay, you look at it and it's like, oh, now we've got Maxwell at seven or English at seven. But I don't think you need to look at it that way, because the batting order will just depend so much on the start you end up getting or not from that top three.
No, it's an interesting point. Marsh hadn't actually bowled that much before this game. And Stoinis, he didn't play today because of a niggle, has bowled pretty well for them recently. So I guess it's like, if they don't see that the difference between their bowling is that great, then I do see why bringing Head in for effectively Stoinis would make sense. But I would say, though, I think that the negative to that is potentially Smith and Labuschagne at 4 and 5, or how do you fit Marsh, Smith and Labuschagne in the same middle order? Head's going to go up to the top. Warner's going to be up top. Marsh has done well in the top order, so you'd think he'd bat three. And then Smith and Labuschagne at 4 and 5 doesn't feel, you know, look at Safka, for example, Markram and Klaassen. It's a very different feeling, numbers 4 and 5. So I guess that is almost the objection to that balance of the side.
Yeah, but I think you just make it dependent on situation. And plus, Smith especially, he can score quickly when the need arises. I mean, we were on the list of that of fastest hundreds by an Australian. Smith is 4 and 5. He's got 62 ball hundreds in the space of a week a few years back. So he can do that. But then also it's like that number 4, number 5 role can just be so different depending on the situation you end up coming in at. And so Australia can almost just have two different players depending on what the situation is. If you're 150 for three or 133 or whatever in between overs 25 and 30, you actually don't mind a Steve Smith or a Labuschagne coming out then. And, you know, you can still get up to 350, you get a push at the end. If you end up getting onto a flyer and you're 200 for two, that's when you promote Glenn Maxwell and he comes out and hits a 40 ball 100. I do get that it makes the side look weird on paper, but I almost think that's the only place it would look weird. And actually you'd have players coming in positions that suit them. Just that might be the number next to their name is weird, but the actual overs in the game make sense, I think.
That's it for part one. In part two, we'll discuss the lack of close games at the tournament so far and preview tomorrow's game, England-Sri Lanka.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Chris asks, is the reason that there are no thrillers because more aggressive batting honed in from T20 skills means that targets can be knocked off quicker or targets can become too high through massive scoring in the final 10 overs? Ben, you spent a fair bit of time today looking at the lack of close games in the tournament. And it's not that we have short memories. Mm-hmm. You looked at the numbers. At this point in World Cups, we normally have had a fair few. Why do you think that is the case? Because I would say that people are a little bit too carried away with close games. Just because a game is not close does not mean it was not good. Mm-hmm. There have been lots of games, I think, that have actually been really good, very watchable games, pretty much until the final point. I think Afghanistan, Pakistan of the day is a really good example of that. Even though on paper, Afghanistan get there by 8 wickets with more than an over to spare. That game was really not quite in the balance, but you could see that going either way until really quite late on in that game. Pakistan, Sri Lanka is another example of that as well. So I don't think we should get too carried away about close games, but also we haven't had many close games.
Yeah, so I was trying to work out, yeah, the percentage of close games per World Cup or how many World Cup games are close, basically. And I was... the metric I came up with, and I did something similar for the Women's World Cup last year, because that was astonishing, the number of close games we were actually getting in that. And it's a similar thing. If you look at wins by 3 wickets or fewer or inside the last over, then that gives you, there's been about 20, I think 29 of those such wins in World Cup history. And then the same, to get the same cutoff for runs is 15 runs, basically. That's the equivalent closest. It's been 29 of those games. In World Cup history, which works out at about 1 in every 8 World Cup games.
We've had more than 8 games.
Yeah, we've had 24 games. You'd expect to have 3 by now, and we've had none. Now, so some of those, that there's a bit of, you know, randomness in there. Some of these games could have got to that stage and just didn't. But yeah, and it's tricky because it's not just fast scoring. This has been the fastest scoring World Cup, but not by that much, by about 4 runs per 100 balls is how much higher the strike rate is in this one compared to 2015. But it's part, like, the batting first thing gets at it a bit, that the questioner mentioned, because I think teams are just batting and chasing much more differently than they have before. I think, like, a team who is set out batting first to make 280 and a team who are chasing 280 going about those in very, very different ways. And we've seen some of those games which might in the past have been close have just been absolute walkovers. And even when there's been an early wicket lost or two, teams have then ended up absolutely cruising. So we came up with some examples, didn't we? So the India-Afghanistan game was chasing 35 overs, chasing 280. That wouldn't have happened at previous World Cups. Same with England-New Zealand. New Zealand absolutely cruised that. So I think it's a combination of those things. And also...
there's an attitude change to chasing. I think in not necessarily in 2019 necessarily, I don't think things have changed that much, but they have changed in the last few years. In that previously teams used to just try and stay within the game and take the game deep. That was a phrase that commentators used to talk about all the time, just take the game deep. Players don't really think about it that way. They see that actually as a high-risk approach because you're sort of leaving the game open to weird things happening even if you've got wickets in hand. Whereas now, teams very much look at chases even around 280, 300 as get it done as quickly as possible. If you've got the momentum, keep the momentum with you. And, you know, as you say, we've had a few chases that have been done in 280, been chasing 35 overs a few times this tournament. I think that is part of it. And just batting first as well, we have just had, I think it's five or six scores at least of 350, 360 plus. Those games are always going to be unlikely to be chased. And also you do just have quite a few mismatches in this tournament. There seems to be quite a big gap, not necessarily in overall quality, but in terms of ability to get 350 plus scores. I think there are some teams that just can't do it. So when that happens against them, you get games like you have today or yesterday where the team batting second is never really in with a shot.
Yeah, and I think we are just seeing a gap between that current top four and the rest a bit as well. Like, I know that, you know, that maybe the semi-final race still does get close, and I guess we'll talk a bit more about that. But I mean, I don't know, we had one upset in that with the Netherlands taking down South Africa, but that is feeling more and more like a proper shock upset, and that those four teams, and it's weird because, you know, the whole point of a 10-team World Cup should be that every game's a blockbuster. That's the argument, is that, you know, you keep the bad teams away and that then, you know,
you've got the 10 elite teams and every game's going to be brilliant between them, but that's not really it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you know, and if you have more teams, then sometimes those weaker teams also play each other and produce close games. If you think back to the last non-10-team World Cup we had in 2015, one of the games of that tournament was Afghanistan versus Scotland, wasn't it? Which won by one wicket. And that was a brilliant World Cup moment because those are two teams that didn't get much chance on the biggest stage. And also, we're seeing the benefits for it from Afghanistan now, I guess, who are the best of the teams outside of that group, I guess, along with Pakistan, if we're including them in the bottom six.
England have a huge game tomorrow, Sri Lanka at the Chinnaswamy. We were so lost in the toss decision on the podcast yesterday that we didn't really get into possible team makeup that much. Would you make any changes to the England team? Well, you have to, because Reece Topley's not there.
Yeah, true. Reece, you're having a bowl, yeah. So. well, Livingston, I think, has to come back. I mean, it's just an odd decision. He bowled really well in the game before the South Africa game. He's got a very handy ODI record. He's a very handy ODI cricketer. Looks like he can be relied upon for 10 overs. I guess that must have been what informed the decision. They went with five proper bowlers.
Yeah, the more I think about that, it's just such a baffling decision. He's the only genuine all-rounder in this England team. If you define an all-rounder as someone who's likely to bowl you 10 overs and bat in the top seven, and it's a World Cup in India, and you've dropped him when he's been your most economical bowler.
Yeah.
So you'd bring in Livingston for...
Topley is one of the players out, so Livingston comes in. But I would also, I think, bring in Cass for Willie. I mean, it's harsh on Willie. I mean, part of the reason why everyone's figures were ugly, firstly, and also he was just struggling with cramp, and I don't think it's going to be as hot tomorrow there in Bangalore rather than Mumbai, where they were before. So, but I still think England, if they're going to stage some sort of comeback, which I think is very unlikely, they need something that kind of changes the feel of them, and they need just something significantly different within their team. I don't think that's Brydon Carr exactly as handy a bowler as he is. For me, that's actually maybe Gus Atkinson taking the new ball. I mean, we saw in the 100 how devastating he can be with that. You've been firm on this. That's how he won his England call-up, was because he was taking wickets with the new ball, and he's not really been doing that for England. And England have really struggled with the new ball overall in this World Cup. So that's the kind of thing that could possibly turn, like, you know, give England the boost they need. I'm not saying it's likely, but if anything's going to do it, I think it might be that.
But it's also potentially, I completely agree with you, but it's probably the worst ground in the tournament to try this out. The Chinnaswamy is really high scoring, really small boundaries. And we saw that spin has gone pretty well there relatively speaking, so far in the tournament. Iftikhar Ahmed took 0-37 off 8 overs against Australia when they got 370. Mm-hmm. So it actually might be the worst possible venue to try out this plan that might work quite well everywhere else.
Yeah, although, I mean, that makes new ball wickets even more important, but it does...
It's more that pace could properly fly in an attack of Atkinson, Carson, Wood. That would leave you relatively vulnerable to that.
Yes, true. Yeah, and I wouldn't be against Wood being the one who sits out either. You give yourself a bit more batting insurance for a team who've been shaky.
He's England's in-form batter.
Huh? Yeah. That is true, yeah. Cruelly deprived of a 50.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, oh God, just for the sake of the tournament, England kind of have to win. Otherwise, you're relying on Pakistan to make the group's ginger, and no one wants to be relying on Pakistan.
Nick asks, is David Willey the most poorly treated England white ball player of recent years? Never quite looks like he's safe in the squad, constantly changing roles, dropped last minute for a World Cup, calls himself a workhorse for the World Cup he is selected for, and then he lost his contract yesterday in the middle of a World Cup.
Yeah, did Willey have a contract, or was he just now the only World Cup player not contracted?
I'm not 100% sure, but he is the only one in this squad not to have a contract.
Yes, which the thing is, these contracts, they're not, it sounds harsh, but they're not rewards. They're not like a, you know, they're not handed out because you bowl a certain amount of overs or whatever. Like, they're done looking forward. And if you look forward from this tournament onwards, like, Willey is slipped down the reckoning in T20 cricket. That's going to be the focus for the next, well, for this contract cycle. You know, even within the 3 years, there's not an ODI World Cup in that. He's obviously not in the test frame. So I get it from that point of view. You know, I've just dropped him. So I'm having sort of boosted his credentials early in the tournament, asking like why he wasn't in the conversation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, he does get a bit of a bad rap. But, you know, it was he calls himself the donkey, doesn't he? That's what he said. He likes being the donkey.
I'm not sure he said he likes to be the donkey, but he sort of saw himself as the donkey.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, like the James Milner, I guess, of English cricket. And then, but then when you're cramping up like that, I mean, James Milner wouldn't be cramping up in that heat, I don't think. So,
yeah, I mean, we had a reasonable discussion on the central contracts on yesterday's pod. I think one thing we missed was one of the more surprising omissions, which was Will Jacks. You know, you're thinking, why have England introduced multi-year central contracts? It's because of the threat, in inverted commas, of franchise leagues being able to lure players away with financially superior deals, potentially to what they can get by touring with England at least. And Will Jacks is someone who already commands deals from everywhere. You know, he got an IPL deal, didn't go because he got injured, one of the best players in the SA20. He's played for England in all three formats in the last year. He is likely to play for England in all three formats in the next year. He's the incumbent T20 opener, actually, because Hales is no longer in the picture. Roy's no longer in the picture. Mm-hmm. Milan bats lower down, or has done recently. He opened against New Zealand. So if that felt really weird, actually, that Jacks didn't get a contract when there were, what, 29 players were given something?
Yeah, especially like Jacks would have been an interesting player in the discussion to actually replace Topley in this squad. I mean,
yeah.
England actually kind of had to go with a quick because of how poor the form of Wokes and Curran is. But like Jacks, yeah, he was well in the conversation to play in this World Cup. Yeah, really, really odd that. And also, it seems from the reports that it's not that he turned it down. The reports have been clear that
everyone who was offered one
accepted some it. Sort of contract, yeah. Even if some were offered three and took two or one. So yeah, that is really odd. And you hope England don't come to regret it in any way, because Jacks ends up being disillusioned by it. I mean, you know,
he's one of the most in-demand white ball players under the age of 25 in the world, I think.
Yeah, and I guess so. There's a tour of the West Indies coming up, which Jack, you'd imagine, would be, you know, penned in for. But then I guess that clashes with the Big Bash, will it? So you'd hope that he doesn't take that sort of choice. You know, no indication from Jacks that he is anything other than entirely focused on playing for England. But I guess that's what happens when you contract so many players, is that players will look at it and think like, you know, one of it's a bit like when they pick that training group at the start of COVID, and you look at players who weren't in that, you're like, wow, I am so far away. And that's kind of the unintentional side effect of wanting to give as many players a thing as possible, that you realize that anyone who isn't will think, hang on, am I really not as well thought of as I thought I was. I think.
Well, that is everything for today. Cheers, Ben. We'll be back tomorrow for reaction after England's game against Sri Lanka.
Sports Social Podcast Network.